From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, a new report finds a 55% increase in anti-Semitic incidents around the state. We'll break down the findings. Then we learn about some local sheroes through a project inspired by the play Eclipsed at the Milwaukee Rep.
These are women that are resilient. These are women that show sisterhood, that are leaders, that exemplify solidarity and collaboration.
New data finds many children of color in Wisconsin go to schools with no teachers who look like them.
The racial achievement gap in Wisconsin is the largest of any state in the United States. Well, some kind of foundational factors for that are students of color do not, for the most part, get the experience of working with a teacher from their same ethnic background.
Plus, we listen to some new local music with Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. This week, the Milwaukee Jewish Federation released a report that found a startling rise in anti-Semitism in Wisconsin. The report was prepared by the Jewish Community Relations Council and found that anti-Semitic incidents increased by 55% from 2018 to 2019. There was a significant increase in threats, harassment, and assaults made on Jewish people. There was also a troubling rise of anti-Semitic activity in middle schools, but a decrease of incidences in high school. The Jewish Community Relations Council says they don't believe more people are feeling animosity towards Jewish people, but that more people feel emboldened to speak about and act on bigoted ideologies. WUWM's Olivia Richardson spoke with the director of the council, Ilana Khan.
When I first started this job 10 years ago, most of the incidents, like all but one or two, were incidents of anti-Semitic expression, oral or written expression. Somebody seeing a swastika somewhere, or somebody posting online, you know, about the whatever, so I'm not going to even repeat it. But there were, in 2012 and in 13, and then again in 15, there was zero incidents of harassment and threats, which are personal types of attacks. I don't mean physical attacks necessarily, but they're personal. They're directed at somebody or an individual or an institution. And in 2015, like I said, there were none of those. And in the last few years, a little bit, but it's been absolutely increasing to the point where this year, more than half of the incidents that we have in our audit are harassment or threats or assault. That's the category, harassment, threats, and assault. I think that is one of the scary data points of this audit. We also see more communication that somebody's involved with a particular hate group by a lot. So in 2018, there was one incident that somehow included information that let us know that the person was part of a hate group, either because they used a particular tag that comes from that, you know, white nationalist group, or they named themselves altogether. And this year, this last year, there were 10 incidents. So that in itself is not, I think it's a huge number, but it went from 1 to 10. And in the last, you know, since I have in front of me the data since 2012, 1 year we had 4 incidents in 2017 of hate group activity. There are 10 this year. So that is another really important data point. And the other is just middle school. Middle school, there's a 250% increase of incidents taking place in middle schools, and most of those incidents include references to the Holocaust or Nazis. I mean, what we're seeing is that there is a brazenness about expressing bigotry. We know that, you know, the ADL came out with data not long ago that said, and they said that they don't believe that there are more people harboring anti-Semitic attitudes. But what we're seeing is those who have those feelings or attitudes are expressing them in much more aggressive ways. So I think that sort of boldness, that willingness to be extreme, and that I might even be a thrill of being non-politic, unkind, that's what I think is really dangerous. And whenever that happens, I mean, we always see a rise in anti-Semitism.
Why now, or why do you think it could be, why people are more comfortable, I suppose, in having that thrill or whatever it is?
I think that it reflects a, this is not my scientific, but my personal experience and what I'm seeing in this work. I think we're in a moment of people feeling deeply insecure and fearful. And the natural thing, and we see it throughout history, is, and when people feel that way, they point fingers and they look to blame somebody, because the world makes much more sense when you can blame somebody. And othering of the Jew is built into Western culture. It is in the groundwater of white nationalism. It is built into many of our traditions. So the building blocks are there, ready to be used when somebody needs to blame somebody else and have their world make sense. So I think that's part of it. And I think another part of it is that there's rhetoric we're hearing from our political leaders that glorifies unkindness and is very dangerous.
Do you guys know if there's any particular social ideology where it might be coming from? Or does it sound like it's kind of coming from multiple social ideologies, I guess?
One of the things that we've seen in our data is the rise of old conspiracy theories that are new again, but particularly this great replacement theory, you know, that says that, and it's old anti-Semitic and racist garbage, that says that the Jews control many things, and among the things that the Jews control in their, you know, malicious intent is they control people of color and are working to for the demise of the white majority or some. It's nonsense, right? Of course it's nonsense. But we've seen in the last few years a return of that great replacement theory that's shown up a lot in social media. And that was a surprise. Like last year, it made sense in retrospect, some incidents we had seen in 2017. In 2018, we went, oh, that's what that was. That's back. And it's the far right and the far left.
Where does Wisconsin compare nationally to the rest of the United States? Like, are we worse off, in the middle?
It's interesting. I think many other places don't have the data that we have. I recently spoke at a national convention about our audit, and I think I knew before that other communities don't do this. I think, I mean, there might be others, but it's mostly done by the national organizations that are in communities. So I think we're unusual in that we count the data as we do, and we've found that other communities are coming to us for help and advice. This has become an area of particular expertise for our Community Relations Council. How does the data compare to other places? You know, I think that the Midwest is, I think that our data is probably consistent with other places. I think that the experience of being Jewish here, you know, mostly this is a wonderful place to be Jewish. And mostly we have, Jews have lots of opportunities here. You know, the interesting thing in Wisconsin is that unlike some other places, we live in a place where there is a significant portion of the population that has never met a Jew. So the experience of being Jewish in Wisconsin is different than it is in places in the East Coast where there are larger Jewish communities, which also provides us an opportunity to have different kinds of relationships. But it means that when our kids go to college, they will meet people who have never met a Jew, and they have to deal with debunking the myths and explaining themselves differently.
I wonder, because I know that the middle school had a sharp increase, it seemed like.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, high school had a smaller increase. So I'm wondering about what is it like for middle schoolers, and then why would the high school, really small, so maybe it's not something to note too much, but.
Right, because it could be reflected in that we had a set of parents that suddenly started reporting things to us differently. So that could be part of it. But also, we know that there's underreporting because every time we talk about the audit or I talk about anti-Semitism anywhere, we hear people saying, oh, this thing happened to my child. Or just last week, somebody, I heard about something awful that had happened at one of our local middle schools, and the parents said, they made people promise secrecy. So I don't know who the people were, and they didn't want anyone doing anything because they didn't want their kids to face a backlash. And your question is, why do we see an increase in middle school and not in high school? I have no idea. I mean, I'm hoping that the bill that's going to the Senate, going through the Senate now, that calls for mandatory education of the Holocaust and other genocides will, and includes one touch during middle school, and then another one during high school, that it will help by not only increasing knowledge about what can happen when hate is unchallenged, but also can do something to help build empathy. You know, help people understand that it could be you. It could be you. It could be somebody you love. And it is an accident of history that it's one people and not another people. The other thing is that it's also that they're totally linked. Like, if you just look at the Holocaust, if you look at the Holocaust as what happens when hate goes unchecked, the targets were not only Jews, but they were the Roma. They were other people of color. They were disabled people. They were LGBT people. So it is never confined to just one group, which gets me to, I think, the most powerful call to action of this audit is that we need to maintain and build alliances with each other because our fate is absolutely intertwined.
Ilana Khan is the director of the Jewish Community Relations Council. She spoke with WUWM's Olivia Richardson about their findings on the rise of anti-Semitism in Wisconsin. We're in the middle of our March member drive here at WUWM, and if you're listening to me right now, I'm guessing you depend on our coverage quite a lot. Please call with your donation at 414-227-3210, or if you're listening right now on the app, you can actually just hit that big red donate button. It takes only a minute of your day to fund hours, days, weeks of listening. Thank you so much for your support. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Milwaukee Rep's latest production is an homage to brave and resilient women living through the Liberian Civil War. Titled Eclipsed, the show is an intimate portrayal of women banding together to lift up their community. And it's with that in mind that Milwaukee Rep launched its Sheroes Project, which is recognizing 12 women of color working to create a better Milwaukee. The project is spearheaded by Leah Harris, the Director of Community Engagement at the Rep, and Katie Avila Luffmiller is one of the recipients. Avila Luffmiller is one of the co-founders of Luna, a local artist collection that works to support Latinx artists in Milwaukee. Both Avila Luffmiller and Harris are here in studio. Thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having us.
So, Leah, why did Milwaukee Rep decide to launch this campaign?
When I was thinking about what I wanted to do for engagement around the story of Eclipsed, I was really drawn to the five women that are in the play, these five characters that were written, I felt like, with so much dimension and texture to who they are and the bond and the sisterhood that they form throughout the story, despite the circumstances that they're in. And I moved here a little over a year ago, and when I first moved here, everyone was telling me about people that I should go meet to have coffee with, to talk about, learn about Milwaukee and learn about arts and culture and community engagement. And so I, you know, my first 6-7 months here was just like meeting with people and just introducing myself. And 9 out of 10 of those people were women and women of color specifically. And so now that I'm a little over a year into the job, I was really wanting to lean into finding the sheroes of Milwaukee. I felt like the women in Eclipse are the sheroes of the story, obviously. And I felt like there was some really beautiful parallels about what I know and the women that have really embraced me here in Milwaukee and have in turn embrace the community. So I felt like if there was one show in our entire season to have a campaign that was dedicated to uplifting the work of women of color, I felt like Eclipse was the best play and has some really beautiful alignment. That was the impulse. And it kind of originally started from a conversation with the director, Maya Drawless, talking about these women in the play. And then that sparked the idea of how I could replicate it for some relevance in Milwaukee.
Now, when you set out to define Shiro, what would make someone a Shiro? What were some of the attributes that, you know, you really wanted to highlight?
Yeah. So again, I was really leaning into the story of the women that were in the play. I mean, these are women that are resilient. These are women that show sisterhood, that are leaders, that exemplify solidarity and collaboration. And so those were just kind of the words that just kept popping up into my head. And those were also the words that I think of when I think of our Shiros and women that are here in Milwaukee. And I knew that I obviously wanted to focus it on specifically women of color, given the demographics of Milwaukee and given the demographics of the 5 women that are in the play. And it's directed by a woman of color. It's written by a woman of color. So I knew that that was also important as well. You have to identify as a woman of color, have to live in Milwaukee for at least the past year, and you have to be working towards the betterment of our community and exemplifying those values of leadership and solidarity and sisterhood and collaboration.
Well, and it feels like from an outside perspective that Luna certainly falls under that. Katie, for people who may not be familiar with Luna, can you explain what your group is?
Sure. So Luna stands for Latinas Unidas en las Artes. We are a Latina artists collective. We started actually in 2017, but didn't really start like being public and out there until 2018. So we're all sorts of different artists. We have illustrators and graphic designers and painters and muralists. We really run the gamut, but we all are Latina, which kind of unifies us.
Did you know that you were going to be nominated for this distinction?
I had like a somewhat of an inkling, but wasn't. I was actually surprised to hear that I had more than one nomination, which was really, really nice to hear. So that was exciting.
Do you know who nominated you?
I think a fellow Luna member nominated me, and I actually think my partner nominated me too, which was really sweet.
That is sweet.
So I don't know if there was anything beyond that, but
when you think of a Shiro, what does that mean to you?
I think what Leah said, I really resonate with that. I don't do my work trying to be anything. I do it sort of like Luna came out of necessity. I also am not actually from Milwaukee, but I moved here about 4 years ago. And about 6 months in, I was just seeing lack of representation. I didn't really feel like I knew where my community was. I met like a bunch of amazing people, but I really wanted to unify. So it was really, and sometimes I even joke that I just really wanted to make some friends. So by leading by example and doing things, not because you want to be a leader, but because you see a need and want to take action. And that's what I see in some of my heroes or Shiros, the women who are just taking action and making space and room for everybody else and making space at the top. There's another Shiro in this first cohort of Shiros. Dasha Kelly Hamilton is one of my personal Shiros in Milwaukee. She's made a lot of room for me creatively in my own personal practice. And so I think that's what I really see as a Shiro, is someone who just kind of leads and leads by example and then also brings a lot of people with them along.
I think people who are familiar with Dasha's work will say that's certainly what she's all about. It seems like that's what Luna is all about. Leah, can you tell us about some of the other women who have been given this distinction?
Yeah, so I think what's so exciting about, you know, we had over 100 nominations come in, and so getting it down to 12 was no easy feat because so many people really kind of poured their hearts into the nomination forms and informing us about these women, and it was also just a learning learn, like an education for me about all these women that I just didn't know. But I think what's so great about our top 12 is that we've really landed across like a multiplicity of professions and occupations. And, you know, there are women that have, you know, like their 9-to-5 job that might be at Marquette, but then they, you know, run a boutique, right? And so, like, I feel like there's just so many, there's such a diversity of experiences, lived experience, perspectives, backgrounds, a little bit of everything in this top 12. Like, I have all of their headshots by my desk right now. And it's like, it really is just so nice to see just what women in Milwaukee look like. And so, yeah, we have women that are across the arts and culture field, nonprofit, working in like medicine and science and academia, education. I mean, it really runs the gamut. And so I feel like it's exciting to have that many different recognitions as well, because I think like with both Katie and I kind of running in like the arts and culture community engagement world, it's also nice to be in conversation with women who are in different worlds as well, but also finding those connections of how we can like lift each other's work up and how we can find those kind of cross-pollination moments are the things that I'm excited about for just being the director of community engagement. Like, I mean, I've known Katie since I've moved here for over a year now, but like now I have like 11 other women kind of that are in my pocket that I can, you know, bounce ideas off of and collaborate with for future things. So I think that's what's really exciting about just the diversity of these 12 women.
Well, Leah, Katie, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing a bit of your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Katie Avila Luff-Miller is a Milwaukee-based artist and one of the co-founders of Luna. Leah Harris is the director of community engagement at the Milwaukee Rep and the person behind its Shiro's project. The project is happening in conjunction with Milwaukee Rep's production of Eclipsed, which is on stage now and runs through the end of March. And of course, we can't bring you conversations like this one without your support. It's our March member drive, and if you love local public radio, then I'm talking to you. Please call us at 414-227-3210. You can also go to wuwm.com/give. And if you're listening to us right now on the WUWM app, all you have to do is press that big red donate button. For a gift of just $60 or $5 a month, you can get the WUWM Milwaukee's NPR Pet Bandana. It comes in two different sizes, so if you're like me and you love putting clothes on your cat, you'll be all set. It fits cats quite easily, small dogs as well, large dogs as well. I have all at home and they're all enjoying it. Please call us at 414-227-3210. You can head to our website, wuwm.com/give, or press the red donate button on the WUWM app. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A report from a University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee researcher highlights one reason African-American teachers may be leaving classrooms: trust issues in the work environment. Surveys taken in 2017 show that Black teachers have lower perceptions of trust with other teachers. It also found that white teachers are less trusting of Black principals. UWM researcher Curtis Jones says the trust breakdown is important for Wisconsin schools to address because the state needs more educators of color. WUWM education reporter Emily Files talked with Jones and Katie Rainey, who works in educator support at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. DPI has partnered with Jones using his research to inform its teacher effectiveness efforts. Jones starts by talking about the racial mismatch between students and teachers in K through 12 schools.
It's really important for a student of color to have at least one experience having a teacher from their same ethnic background, much more likely to graduate high school on time and even go to college.
If a student of color has a teacher who looks like them.
Yes, who's from their background. And so the question was, well, how many students of color are getting that experience in Wisconsin? We know that there's about 33% students of color in Wisconsin. What's been going on with the teaching population, unfortunately, is it hasn't kept up with that. We have outside of the Milwaukee Public Schools, I think it's fewer than 2% of teachers are either African American or Latinx, while I think it's like 15% of students are. And what we ended up finding out was that if you just looked at all of the schools across the state, 86% of schools had no African-American teachers, and 83% had no Latinx teachers, but only 10 schools across the whole state had no African-American or Latinx students.
So the students in Wisconsin are getting more diverse, and the teachers are not. And the vast majority of Wisconsin schools do not have any African-American or Latinx teachers.
That's right.
And then, Katie, do you want to speak to, so there's clearly this issue in the mismatch between students and teachers in Wisconsin schools in terms of the racial demographics. But then there are also some disheartening numbers when it comes to retention of Black teachers especially.
I think Curtis's study helps to identify that we can't just focus on diversifying the pipeline, that we also have to focus specifically on retention. So just getting more educators of color licensed and in buildings is not enough because currently what we're finding is that educators of color are more likely to leave not just the building but the profession at a much higher rate, and that shift, that gap, happens within the first 2 years of their employment. So there's something happening within that first 2 years that is significantly impacting those educators in a way that is different than their white colleagues. And that's regardless of the type of school or district or the population and demographics of that school or district, that across the state, educators of color are leaving the school and the profession at, is it more than double?
It's a lot more than double.
Okay. It's significantly faster within those first 2 years.
Do you want to get into some of those numbers?
Well, I try to remember them directly. And you know, it's important to also consider that that this particular study was one time period. We've looked at other time periods and the numbers are a little different. There's still a big disparity.
And what time period was this study?
This was, I think, starting in 13-14, following teachers through 18-19. And we found that within the first 2 years, the teachers of color had much lower retention rates, both in their school and within the profession. And it's really low for African-American teachers, where I think the retention of teachers in the profession was just barely above 50%.
Okay, so retention is an issue, representation is an issue, and then you explored in this study, you know, one answer to the potential question of why do Black and Latinx teachers leave the classroom at higher rates? And you looked at one possible cause, the trust between teachers and their peers and teachers and principals. So talk about how trust correlated with retention.
Sure, right. We thought, well, let's look at the trust between teachers and teachers and principals as a potential explanation for why a teacher might leave. We knew historically that the trust between a teacher and a principal was probably the biggest predictor of whether or not a teacher would stay in that school. And so we know that
the biggest predictor?
Yeah, of whether or not a teacher would stay in that school, at least of the information that we have. Teachers leave the principal more than they leave the school. And so since there was a lot of teachers of color leaving schools, well, maybe there was something there that was consistent with that. So we found that African-American teachers across the board reported lower levels of trust between teachers in their school, and this is regardless of context, and that white teachers reported lower levels of trust with principals of color and with more diverse teaching groups within a school. So the more diverse the teachers were in a school, the less trust white teachers reported having with those teachers. And so when we accounted for those things, it partially explained some of those retention differences we saw between groups. The trust that we saw between teachers was a pretty strong predictor of whether or not a teacher would stay in that school, and the trust between teachers and principals was also a pretty strong predictor of whether or not they would stay in that school. So it just made sense, and there's a lot of research out there nationally that speaks to this, and so we felt pretty confident that that was at least part of the story.
And it brings up a lot of questions that you can't answer from this existing data,
right,
about why there are these hang-ups in trust between teachers and principals of different races. Katie, what was your reaction to this research?
I think it speaks to bias. And so, you know, that was one of the things that we know is an issue. And to be able to have data to tell a story, even if it's not the full story, is really powerful in terms of informing potential changes or next steps.
What should schools do with this information, and what does DPI plan to do at this point?
The discussions are very new. So we presented this to Cabinet just about a month ago.
What do you mean by that when you say Cabinet?
Sorry. Cabinet is our upper-level leadership. So it includes the state superintendent, Carolyn Stanford Taylor, as well as our deputy superintendent, Mike Thompson, and then each of the assistant state superintendents who are the heads of the five departments within the agency. Dr. Stanford Taylor has been very specific and outspoken about her vision for the agency and having it be a focus on equity. And so their conversations at the cabinet level have been, what does that specifically mean? And what are we going to focus on? And what are the levers and the policy, tools that we can use to try to make a difference for equity within education? And so the timing of this report was just, you know, very timely in that we were able to present to them before they started having some of those conversations. And we basically asked that they consider this data as they go deep into those discussions. Diversifying the workforce is one of the key aspects that they've been talking about. And so we asked them to consider, as they're having the conversation specifically around diversifying the workforce, to focus also on retention.
Mm-hmm. Especially in those first 2 years. It seems like if you can build a strong relationship of mutual trust between a principal and a new teacher in their first 2 years, they're much more likely to stay in that school and to stay in public education.
Exactly.
And Curtis, what do you think are some of the strategies that could be used to help tackle some of the issues raised in this report?
The number one strategy that we've been thinking about related to this has been related to how there's a lot of equity training and bias training that teachers are going through and have been going through within schools. And it's been focused on teachers' relationships with students of color and with parents of color. And so a lot of teachers understand implicit bias and things like this that are in relation to how they're interacting with students and parents. I don't know of any initiatives in Wisconsin that are focused on how teachers work together to promote trust amongst each other. Increasing the pipeline is an important part of this, but what we need to do is make the teaching profession more attractive to persons of color. As it is right now, how are we going to sell this to a person of color as a career opportunity if we know that they're going to be placed into a school where they're likely having lower trust with other teachers and less satisfaction with their job?
Mm-hmm. Right. You don't want to be saying to future teachers of color, enter this field, you have a 1 in 2 chance of staying in your job in 2 years.
Right.
Because basically half of new African American teachers leave their school.
Right.
Within 2 years.
That's right. We need to figure out how to keep the teachers we have before recommending a bunch of new teachers to go into that system.
Because ultimately it's better for kids.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, a big part of this research was about, you know, the fact that the racial achievement gap in Wisconsin is the largest of any state in the United States. And why is that? Well, some kind of foundational factors for that are students of color do not, for the most part, get the experience of working with a teacher from their same ethnic background. And the teachers in the schools with the, majority students of color are still majority white and are much less likely to stay in those schools. So teacher retention on both ends of this harms the students of color and then exacerbates that achievement gap. We need to figure out how to fix the human resource system within Wisconsin schools so that it promotes gap closing, not gap expansion.
Curtis Jones is a senior scientist and education researcher at UWM, and Katie Rainey is director of educator development at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. They joined WUWM's education reporter, Emily Files. Emily is interested in hearing from Black and Latinx teachers to talk about their experiences working in Wisconsin schools, and whether this research into retention and trust really resonates with what they've seen. You can reach her at Files, F-I-L-E-S, at uwm.edu. And we are in the middle of our March member drive. You can go to wuwm.com/give, or you can head to the WUWM app or call 414-227-3210 for a gift of just $60 or $5 a month. You can get a pet bandana to give your furry friend a fresh new look, and let people know what your pets are listening to when you're out of the house. We'll take one last break and then return with some new local music curated by Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Joy Powers. Matt Wild is one of the co-founders of Milwaukee Record, which describes itself as an online source for music, culture, and gentle sarcasm. Among the many cultural things Milwaukee Record keeps track of is a nearly exhaustive list of new music from local musicians. Matt is the curator of that list, and he joins Lake Effect every month to share with us a sample of what he's been listening to. We call it the Milwaukee Music Roundup, and Matt is here in studio. Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Hi, well, thanks for having me once again.
So, your first band on your list of best songs to listen to in February?
Yes.
Is Rex. Tell me a bit about this band. The musicians have a long history here in Milwaukee.
They certainly do. We should start out by saying, yes, this band is named Rex. And it has the very exciting triple X. It's R-E-X-X-X. And we're gonna see more of those triple X's during this segment. But for now, yes, Rex, if you follow Milwaukee music at all, I don't know if you could say this would be a super group. I don't know. Some people laugh at that kind of term. But it does feature a lot of Milwaukee music veterans who are kind of the current crop of players that are playing in tons of bands today. Features members of Surgeons in Heat, Midnight Reruns, former members of the late, great No-No band, many other bands. And they have formed together to create this hard-partying, hard-rockin' band called Rex. And they've just put out their debut full-length album, which is called Pure Pleasure 2. There is no Pure Pleasure 1, as far as I know. So
it's, I wondered.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. I could be mistaken, but I don't think I am. So it's Pure Pleasure 2, and it's one of my favorite records, Milwaukee Records, so far this year. The year's obviously still early, but like I said, this is a super fun party record. Call it what you want, party rock, punk rock, kind of lands somewhere on that spectrum, and it's just a ton of fun, and to see these fellows live is a blast, and they've been playing out for a little while. They will continue to play out throughout this year, so I would absolutely recommend checking them out. They're a ton of fun. The band's name is Rex. The song we're going to listen to is, I believe, the lead-off track to the album. It's called Can't Help It.
Out about this song to you?
What I love about this, and what I love about a similar Milwaukee band that kind of shares a lot of DNA with this band, the Platinum Boys, is that they're a party band, and it's a very, positive party vibe. I like that about these bands. It's not like the party bands of old, you know, your Motley Crues or your Poisons and that, which, especially in the light of today, seem a little icky. These guys are not that. It's very wholesome, very positive party vibe, and I like that. A lot like, you know, someone like Andrew W.K., who's just all about the healing energy of partying, and that's what I love about this band.
All right, so the next song comes from Juicebox, and you describe him as a kind of Milwaukee legend. What makes him legendary?
Oh, boy, a lot. There is a, I don't know if anyone Milwaukee-related has had such a long and strange career as Juicebox. Might I add three X's at the end of Juicebox as well. Juicebox, originally from the Milwaukee area. These days, he's kind of in New York a lot of the times. He's in L.A. a lot of times. I'm not sure where exactly he is, but we'll always call him our own. He started playing out when he was only like 13, 14, or 15 years old, just playing these like basement shows and rapping and kind of being this punk kid. And he's been at it now for decades. He's in his 30s now. And he's still out there. He's put out a ton of records. His latest is on Danger Bird Records. The title of his new album, which is great, is called It's Easy to Feel Like a Nobody When You're Living in the City. That really kind of sums up what Juicebox is all about these days. He's all about kind of really grappling with his career, where it's not that he hasn't been a success, but, you know, he's still kind of this underground artist, and he's been playing, you know, these basement shows for years and years and years and small clubs. But like I said, he's had a very strange career. So he's playing all these small shows, and then suddenly one year he'll be opening for Public Enemy in London or something like that. And then the next year he'll have his own energy drink, and he's had a book written about him, and he's been kind of this viral star. He had kind of a unfortunate appearance on a local news station here in town a few years ago. Some malfunctioning sound, and kind of became a viral YouTube star because of that performance. So he's had this very, very strange career. But what I love about him, he's still out there doing this. Like I said, he's kind of grappling with that. He's like, why am I still doing this? And that's a theme that comes up a lot in this in his new album. The song we're going to listen to is called In the Basement. And it's about just kind of what I was talking about, kind of grappling with this legacy, his history of, you know, playing these lousy basement shows, and why does he still do it? But he's going to keep doing it. It's all he knows.
All right, here it is, In the Basement.
I was rolling on the ground, on the concrete, a couple punks and a lot of insecurity. Have I wasted all my life in the basement? Have I wasted all my life in the basement? So behind, even though I got a head start, spazzing out, but you know I'm gonna fall apart. Have I wasted all my life in the basement? Have I wasted all my life in the basement? Am I alone to do?
So this song is from the album, as you mentioned, It's Easy to Feel Like a Nobody When You're Living in the City. What I found interesting about this title is, to me, it doesn't quite speak to Milwaukee as much as it does speak to a city like New York, like L.A., where, you know, we always call it Smallwaukee in part because you know everybody. It is a kind of close-knit community. But when you're in New York, when you're in L.A., these are places where you can feel a little lonely. Do you think his music has changed as a result of moving to the coasts?
I think it has, and I think it's changed with his age as well. Like I said, he started out very, very young and was, you know, like I said, kind of this punk kid with a ton of energy. And as he's gotten older, I find him much more interesting as an artist because he is dealing with the fact that he is getting older and he's still doing this. And I think he speaks to people like kind of my age and around my age, too. When I go to his shows, it's a lot of folks like around my age who are you know, close to his age too, but kind of look up to him as this guy that's, well, you know, he's still doing this, and there's part of us that are like, yay, you know, at least he's doing it. So yeah, I find him an endlessly fascinating artist and super talented too.
So moving from Juicebox, a Milwaukee legend, to a relatively new band, Operations. This next song is actually from their debut album.
Yes, debut album. The name of the album is called Fog Museum, which is a kind of a lovely, evocative title for an album. And it really sums up this band as well. The band is Operations, and they've only been around for maybe a year or two. I think they started in December of 2018. And it does feature some kind of Milwaukee music veterans, most notably Alyssa Rodriguez, who plays in a number of other bands, including Sundial Mottos. She plays solo under the name Apollo Vermouth. So she's always very busy, and it's great to hear her here in a new band. And I just love this kind of music. It's very shoegazy, very quiet, very hushed for fans of, you know, something like Yola Tango or something like that. Or in Milwaukee, they remind me a lot of Brief Candles, another band that sounds like this. It's just one of those records you want to put on from front to back, from start to finish, and just kind of let wash over you. And the song we're going to listen to from that album is the lead-off track, I believe. It's called Perfect Day, not to be confused with the Lou Reed Perfect Day song. And it's lovely. I really adore this song. There's a video for it as well. You can search that out, too, which features some of the band members driving a semi, which somehow it sounds strange, but it does fit in with this song very nicely. So, yes, this is Operations with Perfect Day.
Day from Operations. So the final song we'll be looking at, it's from Long Line Riders. And to me, they feel like they're part of a larger movement here in Milwaukee of people who are having a lot of Americana, kind of country-inspired bands, music. But they've kind of taken it to the next level, and they're not just country-inspired. They're really playing old country hits.
Right, yeah. Usually I wouldn't pick a cover band for this sort of thing. And the Long Line Riders do describe themselves as playing, I quote, a goodly portion of classics and lesser-known country, western, and honky-tonk numbers. But I find them absolutely enjoyable. And you're right, it's not the alt-country of past decades. It's not country-inspired, as you said. It is like old-school, kind of Hank Williams, kind of Loretta Lynn kind of country. It is honky-tonk would be, another perfect way to describe this. And like I said, they're just an enjoyable band, a great band to see live. And I know they have a lot of live shows coming up. Speaking of that, of course, the record that they just put out, a self-titled record, is a live record. It was recorded last summer at the 2019 Bayview Bash. And I love when Milwaukee bands release live records. It doesn't happen nearly enough as it should, I think. There have been a few notable ones in recent years. Classic put out a terrific one last year, and there are plenty of others, but I wish more people would do this. I really love live records, and I really love like a great set from a street festival like the Bayview Bash. So listening to this now, in February, March, in the middle of winter, it's just a great feeling to take myself back to last summer. So the song we're going to listen to is Pick Me Up on Your Way Down. a song popularized by Charlie Walker, written by Harlan Howard back in the day. And, yeah, like I said, a live performance. I think the Long Line Riders do a rootin' tootin' job here.
All right, pick me up on your way down. Down, performed by the Long Line Riders. And I think I was actually there for this concert when they, or this show, I think.
I love the Bayview Bash and all of Milwaukee Street Festival. You can just wander around and bump into, you know, goodness knows what, something, you know, like classic country like this, to loud punk bands, to loud rock bands, to hip hop, to the whole nine yards. So yeah, think summer, think spring, think summer.
When you're listening to this album, does it have kind of the hallmarks of a live album where you hear a lot of that audience participation?
You don't hear a lot of audience participation. It's not like, you know, recorded from a microphone, like back, you know, in the audience. It's recorded like off the boards or something. It's very closely recorded, but it is very raw. It's very clearly a live performance. It's not super polished. It's not, you know, clearly not done in the studio, and I like that. So while you can't hear the crowd, you can't hear the hustle and bustle of Bayview Bash, it's still clearly a live album. And I love that energy. I love that raw energy in those kind of recordings.
Yeah. I think our listeners have a lot to listen to.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Matt Wild is one of the co-founders of Milwaukee Record. Every month he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup, and he talks with us about a few of those songs. You can find Wild's full list at WUWM.com. And while you're there, you can donate to our March member drive. If you're on the website or on the WUWM app, you can just press that big red donate button. We try to make it pretty easy, make it very transparent. Donate. Big red button. You can also call us at 414-227-3210. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.